Tonight, I wanted to start a little series on basic Christian doctrine, and this will be sort of a refresher for some of you, and or perhaps brand new to some of you, I don't know. But I wanted to start off with the doctrine of redemption, sort of why we sang that last song tonight. And got a little PowerPoint. I hope you've got your Bibles with you. I don't like putting the whole scripture verses up on the screen because you get lazy. I want you to use your Bible. If you don't have one, look around under the seat in front of you, see if you can spot one. But if you can possibly get a Bible out and follow along with these references that we're going to be looking at tonight. I want to start out with part one, and we'll probably have a part two next week. Guess you can figure that out. That we'll deal with Old Testament references to the notion of redemption and then New Testament references next time. Now, you need to understand that there is a reason, even though everything in the Old Testament is pointing us forward to the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ, there is a reason for the Old Testament, that it is fundamental to our understanding of certain things in the New Testament. And number one, it is the glossary. You know what a glossary is? A lot of times you'll have terms that are used in a book, and you turn to the back of the book, and there's a glossary, and it is giving you the definition of the words that are being used. Now, in our day and time, do we use the word redemption very often? Have you used it at all in 2018? Probably not. Have you, Olivia? See, you shake. Now, how did you use the word redemption? I'm curious. Oh, you were talking. There you go. Okay. I should have known. Having these deep theological discussions, right? Okay. I do remember as a child, my mother collected green stamps. Some of y'all old enough to remember those. And you fill up a book of green stamps, and you'd go to the green stamp, and it was called the Redemption Center, right? You redeem the stamps. And so my first confrontation with the word redemption was at the green stamp place. I still didn't quite understand it, but I knew that those books of green stamps basically functioned like money. And so you went, and to redeem something meant that you purchased it and you bought it. And of course, that is sort of the fundamental understanding of how redemption works. But in the Old Testament, there are three basic words that are translated or at least conceptualized the notion of redemption. Now, whether in your version they're translated that way may be up to question, but these three words are pretty much the words that we see translated, at least in the King James, into the word redemption. One is a Hebrew word, padah, the other is ga'el, and the other is kafar. So we'll be looking at those three words for a little bit this evening. Let's take that first one, padah. How is it used in Scripture? Number one, and if you would, turn over to the book of Numbers as we go. Numbers chapter 18. Joe, since you're sitting up here front and center, let me get you to read Numbers 18, and there's two verses here, verses 15 and 16. Okay. You ready? You're ready to go. Read loud.
Everything that openeth the matrix in all flesh, which they bring unto the Lord, whether it be of men or beasts, shall be thine. Nevertheless, the firstborn of man shalt thou surely redeem, and the firstling of unclean beasts shalt thou redeem. And those that are be redeemed from a month old shalt thou redeem according to thine estimation for the money of 5 shekels after the shekel of the sanctuary, which is 20
gerahs. Yeah. Okay, here is directions to the priests. And they are being told that the firstborn, the one that opens the matrix, we would say womb, of man or beast in Israel, belongs to the Lord, the firstborn of man, the firstborn of beasts. Why would that be true? Anybody have any idea? What is that relating back to?
Because
to the Passover. In other words, remember at Passover, the firstborn was killed unless there was the blood of the Passover lamb over the doorpost. And it wasn't just firstborn of man, it was firstborn of beast as well. So all firstborn, in the sense that God spared in Israel, is seen as then belonging to him. He has a claim on it. And notice, as you sort of study these laws of redemption, and here we have just a little glimpse at them, what you find is if the animal, the firstborn of an animal, if it is a lamb or a cow, calf, what do you do with it? You offer it as sacrifice. In other words, if it is a clean animal, and keep in mind there were five, I say clean, a subset of the clean animals, five of types of animals were offered as sacrifices. What are they? It's a little quiz.
Sheep.
Goats. Are you going to let Al get all the thunder here? I'm already giving you a hint. Cows, calves, doves, one more, pigeons. Doves and pigeons, two different kinds of birds, and then calves, lambs, kid goats, okay? So you've got those five animals that are offered on the altar in Israel. If it's one of those five animals that is the firstborn, then you simply offer it, you bring it to the tabernacle, you offer it in sacrifice to God. What if it's a donkey? Well, okay.
A donkey's unclean.
There you go. A donkey is unclean. So, well, yeah, you've got all this regulation about what is a clean animal. If it's a mammal, it has to have a split hoof, has to have chew the cud. But there you go. It's not a mule now, okay? Not a hybrid, but it is a donkey. And the donkey can't be offered on the altar. So what do you do? That's what you just read, huh? You redeem it. That's what he's telling them in the case of a donkey or an unclean animal. You don't sacrifice it, but you must redeem it. And he gives them the guideline here. He's telling the priest, by your estimation, you put a value on this thing. Here's your guideline. You put a value and you give this much silver. Keep in mind, there were no coins in that day. Your money was a weight of silver. That's what this gira and the shekel of the temple, the sanctuary, had a certain weight, and that was the evaluation. Now, what about if it's your child? What if it's a firstborn human? What do you do with him? You redeem him. Do you realize that that puts a firstborn human in the same category as an unclean animal? What does that tell you? That human, man, natural man, sinful man is not fit to be an offering. You can deduce that from that. If he's mere human, fallen man is in the same category as an unclean animal. And so what do? Well, you redeem him. You have to buy him back. That's the idea. The word used here in this discussion of redemption is this word, padah. And padah has the flavor of substituting one thing for another. I mean, we are sort of in a different world. We don't, you know, at one time, societies lived by the barter system, where you have some chickens and you have some flour, and you get together and you swap chickens for flour, okay? We're in a day where we have money, we have these green pieces of paper in our pocket, go figure, and that is the substitute. But still, we are substituting, and padah seems to have that flavor behind it when you see it used. All right, another text, Exodus 8, verse 23. I did not look in other versions, and I'm sort of curious how this reads in some of the other versions. In Exodus chapter 8, verse 23. Now, let me set the context for you. If you back up, you'll notice there's swarms of flies being threatened on Pharaoh. This is one of the plagues of Egypt. And God is going, verse 22, to set apart the land of Goshen where his people are, that there'll be no swarms of flies there, so that Pharaoh will know that he's the Lord, okay? And then in verse 23, here's the verse. And I will put a division between my people and thy people. Tomorrow shall this sign be. How does anybody have another version besides King James? He said he's going to make a difference. What does he say? I will put the first part of that verse, Cheryl. Make a difference. Well, in the Hebrew, it is, I will make a padah. It is using that same word. In other words, it's the same root, padah, in a different form, but it's the idea, I will put a redemption between you and my people. What do you have? She has it in a footnote. So what are you reading? I mean, what version? NIV, what are you reading? New King James. Anybody have another? ESV, how's it read? Like the King James. Well, that's the idea, of course, but isn't it interesting that the word padah is used there? This word for redemption is the idea that there's going to be redemption for them that's not for you. And of course, this notion of substitution, and especially that scene in the Passover, where the Passover lamb perishes and the son does not. And the reason the son is passed over is because an offering, a substitute in this case, is dying in the place of the firstborn son in the home. All right? And then let's go to Numbers chapter 3. And here the idea of substitution really jumps out. I wish we had more time to look at this one text in great detail. We don't. But in Numbers chapter 3, starting in verse 40, and I'm not going to have anybody read this because of the length. It's about 11, 12 verses here. But what's happening is God says, okay, I redeemed your firstborn sons, okay? But I'm going to make a swap. He is just numbered. I mean, the book of Numbers is called the book of Numbers for a reason. There's a whole bunch of numbering going on. And they numbered a number of things. They numbered the people in each tribe. They numbered the Levites. And they numbered the number of firstborn sons that had been spared at Passover. Okay? And guess what? The number of firstborn sons was almost exactly equal to the number of Levites. So God says, the firstborn belongs to me. Remember, I saved them. I redeemed, I've spared them. So they're mine. But I tell you what, I'm going to take the tribe of Levi in their place. And if you ever wondered why the Levitical tribe was the priestly tribe. Remember, the priests were one family within Levi, within the tribe. There were three major family divisions, the Kohathites, the Merariathites. What was the other one? Moriah, Kohath, Gershom. That's the third. There are three major family divisions within the tribe of Levi. And then you had the descendants of Aaron, who were the priests. So that was yet a fourth division within the tribe of Levi. So there's a whole bunch more Levites than there are priests. Let me state it this way. Every priest then had to be a Levite, but not every Levite was a priest. Make sense? Okay. Had to be a descendant of Aaron to be a priest, one of the branches of the tribes of Levi. So anyway, Lo and behold, there's almost an identical number of Levites as they are of the firstborn. And so what he says, look in verse 45, take the Levites instead of the firstborn among the children of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites instead of their cattle, and the Levites shall be mine. In other words, I'm going to notice the notion of substitution here going on. I'm going to substitute Levite for firstborn. And so they came up. Notice there was a difference. They had 200, in verse 46, 273 firstborn that were more than the Levites. Now, that's pretty good. I mean, I can't remember the exact number, but there was like 22,000 Levites and 22,000 and change firstborn. And so, but when you're going to do a swap here, and you'd have thought God would have just said, oh, what's the difference? Keep the change. There's 273 more of these than there are them, but he didn't. Notice what he does. In verse 47, then thou shalt even take 5 shekels apiece by the pole after the shekel of the sanctuary shalt thou take them. The shekel is 20 gerahs. There you are again, Joe. And you'll give the money wherewith the odd number of them is to be redeemed unto Aaron to his sons. No, God didn't let it go. He said, you got 273 of them. In that case, I'll let you buy them. I'll let you purchase them, redeem them with money. But everybody else, I want a Levite in the place of the firstborn. So if you're ever curious about how did we get Levites as the priestly tribe, this is how. But notice that already we are setting, here's the glossary of terms. Already the predominant thought of redemption here is substitution. You see that? Okay, let's go to the next one. Gael. In the case that an Israelite became poor, should have a lot of people here identify with that notion. You got the rich folks getting richer and richer, and poor folks getting poor and poor. The Israelite becomes poor, and he can't make it anymore. I'm thinking about my family history. My mother's folks came from over here in Hardin County, Tennessee, and they went to Texas to try to make it. And failed, and my granddad moved the family back, and they lived with relatives up here around Adamsville. And then he went back, tried again, failed again. They wound up living with an aunt and uncle up here in the Boot Hill of Missouri. And then finally they went back to Texas, and that time, well, he never was much of a farmer, but he finally quit farming and got a job. So anyway, that's my mother's side of the family. That's how they wound up in Texas. There's a lot of that stuff going on, but what do you do if you're an Israelite and you can't make it? It's an agricultural nation. Let's suppose you, don't make a crop one year. That's very possible. The rains don't come, whatever the case. You fail and you can't make it. What do? Well, you got two options. You can sell your land and you can sell yourself. Now, keep in mind, if you sell your land, you might as well go ahead and sell yourself, because if you ain't got no land, you got nothing, no way to make a living anyway, because it's an agricultural nation. You've got no way to make crops. So in the case that you cannot feed your family, you can't survive, there was a way out. You would sell your land, the inheritance that you had received. Remember when the tribal divisions were made, you got a portion of this that's your land, your family's land. Remember, we've sort of traced David's inheritance back to the area of Bethlehem, was where he, Nashon, the first head of the tribe, got land there. Then his son Salmon got land. He followed him, inherited his land. And then a fellow we know is Boaz, inherited his land. That's why Boaz, in the story of Ruth and Boaz, he's got the land. Everybody's working for Boaz out there reaping, gleaning wheat. So anyway, that's the situation. Now, you could sell your inheritance, but you get it back. It's a pretty good system. In the year of Jubilee, which is 7 sevens of years, 49 years plus one, in the 50th year, all the land returns back to the original owner. So you can't, really what you're doing is leasing the land. not really selling it, because you're going to get it back in the year of Jubilee. Plus, you go free in that year. But in the meanwhile, if you happen to have a rich relative, you know, that rich uncle, it, you and the land can be redeemed. And the term gael is the payment. Let me read how I've stated it here. Should an Israelite become poor and sell himself or his inheritance in order to survive, a gael denotes the payment on the part of a near kinsman that recovers the poor man from his slavery or from the loss of his inheritance. Now, they prorated the price depending on how far you were away from the year of Jubilee. Obviously, you only got 1 year to go until the year of Jubilee, and not going to lease your land for much. If you got 49 years, you get a pretty good price for it. But you're without your inheritance unless you've got a rich near kinsman. Of course, you know the story of Ruth and Boaz. This whole notion of the near kinsman comes into play. Boaz was that for Ruth, although, recall, there was a nearer kinsman who had to first decline before Boaz could then redeem the land. And then there's another Israelite law coming into play here, the Levirate law, which is very much akin to the laws of redemption. The brother-in-law could marry his brother's wife, and it would be his brother, the brother-in-law to the wife, who has died, if he has not, if he doesn't have a male descendant. There's no one to inherit his property, keep his name going. And so in that case, the brother-in-law of the widow was to marry her and have a son by the dead brother's name. In other words, the son then is considered the brother's son, not your son, and will inherit the land that the brother had. So if you got you an ugly sister-in-law, you pray her husband doesn't die, okay? Because if so, guess what? You're the one that's supposed to step into the picture and have children by her in the name of the brother. Now, that apparently was what was going on in the case of Ruth and Boaz, that here was a nearer kinsman than Boaz to Ruth. Now, you know, Hollywood, I remember seeing a movie about Ruth long ago, and they make her look like a glamorous movie star. She was a field hand out in the fields every day. I don't think she probably was the most prettiest thing you ever saw in your life, okay? And so I doubt romance, glamour, had a lot to do with this. What did have to do with it was the fact that this nearer kinsman apparently himself did not yet have a male descendant. Remember, he tells Boaz, I'm not going to do it because I don't want to mess up my own inheritance. In other words, if he marries her and has a son, it won't be considered his son. It'll be considered the son of his brother. And if he doesn't have a son of his own, then he's not helping himself at all. So he is declining. And Boaz then jumps into the picture and marries Ruth and indeed has children by her. Obed, whose son was Jesse, whose son was David. So you see how that worked out in that case. Okay, there's what's going on. But notice the idea of an inheritance. Paying a price to redeem the person or the land is a gael. The person doing it was a goel. That's just the noun form of the verb. This is speaking of the to buy, to pay, the payment rendered. In case to free the man from his slavery or to get back the property that came in your inheritance. The goel is the guy who does that. And that word is usually translated in the Old Testament, redeemer. So you've got a redeemer, a goel, who is making a gael, a payment to redeem. Okay, you with me? Hopefully that's clearer than mud. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 25. Verse 24. I'm just going to read a little of this. We'll probably skip the next one. But notice, if thy brother wax be waxen, that if he becomes poor and hath sold away some of his possession, and if any of his kin come to redeem it, then shall he redeem that which his brother sold. And if the man have none to redeem it, and he himself be able to redeem it, then let him count the years of the sale thereof, and restore the payment unto the man to whom he sold it, that he may return it unto his possession. If he be not able to restore it, then that which is sold shall remain in the hand of him that hath bought it until the year of Jubilee, and in the Jubilee it shall go out, and he shall return unto his possession. And then we have a similar text down in verse 47, where we have the man himself selling himself to a stranger or to someone else. And verse 48, after he is sold, he may be redeemed again. One of his brethren may redeem him, either his uncle's son, a nephew may redeem him, or any that is nigh of kin unto him of his family may redeem him, or if he be able, he may redeem himself. You can buy yourself back, buy your freedom, okay? So again, notice the same principle, whether it's you yourself being sold into slavery or your land. And the notion of Gael, now let's think, Padah, the overall governing concept of Padah is the idea of substitution. I'll take this for that, okay? What would you say here in Gael? What's the focus on here? What? Payment. Any other? Notice with the Gael, it's a family matter. Because it's not just anybody that comes along and redeems you. It's a near kinsman who would redeem you. And it's not anybody that can go buy that property back because, in other words, notice it's somebody else in your family. It was family land that got sold, and now someone else in your family is buying it back. And that the notion of Gael is all about relationship. It's, yes, it's a payment that a near kinsman makes in order to bring something back, to retrieve, or perhaps a better word is the recovery of that which has been lost through a payment being made. We lost the land, or we lost my freedom, and the Redeemer purchased it back. Okay? So notice a little bit different flavor of these words. And then there's yet a third word, kafar. And some of you, if you've ever looked at Hebrew at all, may be familiar with this word. Does it jump out at anybody? I was sort of hoping somebody might recognize it. It's the word that's usually translated to atone. It's the notion of atonement. The word, however, literally means to cover. And to cover in the sense of putting something out of sight. Some of you may have been sort of acquainted with the notion that in the Old Testament, the notion of atonement was not so much expiation. Expiation is to do away with the sin. Atonement is more to cover it, to put it out of sight for the time being. So the Old Testament sacrifices then, according to the book of Hebrews, never did take away sin. But it put it out of sight for a while. It covered it in that Old Testament system until Christ came who made the true atonement. Okay? So this is the same word, and strangely, this is strange to my thinking, that that word sometimes carries with it the notion of redemption. Now that's interesting to me. Let me give you a couple of examples here. Let's go to Exodus 21. In other words, as we well know, just to look up a word in the dictionary, you may find a word. You say, well, what does it mean? Well, I think it was Tom Wells. Some of y'all have read some of Tom Wells' books. I was having a conversation with him up in Pennsylvania years ago. And he said, I can't remember which word it was. He put out a common word. And he says, you look it up in the dictionary, that has 72 different meanings. 72 different meanings to that one word. You say, well, it should be simple. Let's just go get a definition. Well, what he's pointing out, what Tom was pointing out, is that context is what makes all the difference in what words mean. You can say, well, it means this. Well, it may mean this in one context. It may mean something completely other in another context. Let's take the word dress. In one context, you ladies, do you have a dress on? Or in another context, did you dress yourself? You say, well, that's different. That's a noun and a verb. Okay. Did you how about dressing yourself and dressing a deer? Two completely different concepts and yet same word. And so context is really what is so essential. We can look at the meaning of a word. In this case, kafar means to cover. But the real question is, how is it being used? How is it being utilized? Are you here in Exodus 21, verse 29. This is in the law where you've got an ox that belongs to you that gets out and gores somebody to death. All right? Today, they just go get an attorney and sue the socks off you. Okay, but here's under the Old Testament law. Here's what they want to find out. In verse 28, if the ox gore a man or a woman that they die, then the ox shall surely be stoned and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be quit. You're familiar with a quit claim deed? In other words, the owner of the ox is free from any punishment or charges if the ox has never been goring anybody before, if he had no knowledge that it was a vicious animal, so to speak. Then the ox dies, he loses his ox, and you can't even eat the meat, but at least you keep your life. But if the ox were wanton to push with his horn in time past, in other words, this is one mean bull, he constantly is trying to gore, and it hath been testified to his owner. The owner knows it. And he hath not kept him in, but that he killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and his owner also shall be put to death. We would call that something akin to manslaughter, second-degree murder. Wasn't intended, wasn't first-degree murder, but you were still responsible for the man's life. But look at verse 30. If there be laid on him a sum of money, then he shall give for the ransom of his life whatsoever is laid upon him. And again, the word ransom here is this word, kafar. And it has the notion of redemption. Any of your versions read that way? Josh, how do you read verse 20, chapter 21, 31? Or no, 30. 21, 30. He shall give for the redemption of his life. This word, atonement, a cover. Interesting. But notice how it's being used here. Again, you've got the idea of substitution. He should die, but he can come up with money and ransom himself by his way out of condemnation. Let's go to another. No, we will not go. Oh, I've got another one here, but it's roughly the same type of thing. In other words, okay, there's your three basic terms that are used in Hebrew for this notion of redemption, okay? Just in closing, the concept of redemption is used also in three different ways. And I'm not talking about now these three different words necessarily, because you'll find a sprinkling, a mixture of those in each one of these concepts. Number one, that God redeems nationally. That God in the Old Testament is referred to as the Redeemer of Israel. I've got a whole bunch of text here. I don't know why. I thought, see if it stuck, Charles. I think they're supposed to be. Oh, okay, well, let's just wing it. Go to Isaiah. Isaiah is the one place that you find this over and over again in these prophecies in the last 27 chapters, which is looking ahead to the New Covenant age over and over again. In Isaiah 41:14, fear not, thou worm. That's very flattering. Fear not, thou worm. Jacob, and ye men of Israel, I will help thee, saith the Lord, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. I'm going to come, you're a worm. Got no power, no beauty, but I'm going to come to your aid. I'm going to be your Redeemer. In chapter 43, verse 1, but now thus saith the Lord, who created thee, O Jacob, he who formed thee, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by thy name, thou art mine. I purchase you, you see, for myself. 44, verse 6, thus saith the Lord, the King of Israel and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first, I am the last, beside me there is no God. Again, the notion that God is Israel's Redeemer. And then 47, verse 4, here's Israel speaking, as for our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Okay, I look at this last section of Isaiah's looking ahead to us, to our age. And God is saying, I'm going to redeem my people. Of those words that we looked at a moment ago, which one would you just guess is the one that's being used in all these texts here in the book of Isaiah? You got one chance out of three. You've got pada, which is the idea of substitution. Gael, which is the idea of a kinsman, a near kinsman purchasing you. And then kafar, the idea of covering it over. You think kafar? Wrong. Wrong door. Is, what's that? Pada, and door number two. And that's significant because Christ is our Redeemer. And the book of Hebrews makes a big deal that he became man in order to redeem man, that he is our near kinsman. He became one of the race in order to redeem the race. You see the connection? And so, there's no great surprise. Apparently, I'm not surprised, some of y'all may be, that it's that word, Gael, that it is the kinsman redeemer concept that is being shown here. But that's not the only way redemption is used. It's used nationally, as you see here in this text, of the nation of Israel. Secondly, it's used individually. Let me give you just we don't have time to go through all of them. In Genesis 48:16, Joseph is being blessed by Jacob, and Jacob blesses him in the name of his God, he said, who redeemed me from all my distresses. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and now my God, the God who redeemed me from my ill. In other words, the idea he has delivered me out of all my trouble. That, in the name of that God, I'm blessing you, Joseph, and your two boys, Ephraim and Manasseh. In 2 Samuel 4, verse 9, David has just gotten news that Saul has died. And you remember, Abner has died. I'm trying to think of my context here, 2 Samuel 4. Abner has died, and two guys assassinated him, and thinking that they're going to bring his head to David and be rewarded. And David, he rewards them all right, saying, you've killed a man more righteous than you. And in that context, he speaks of God as redeeming him from all his enemies. We think of the years David was on the run from King Saul, and that God has delivered me, he's redeemed me. And you begin to see this idea of rescue and recovery. Some of these is Gael, some of them are Padah, depending on which reference. Job. Job 19, verse 25. Anybody quote that? Think a minute. You've heard the verse, I'm sure. There you go. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and he shall stand upon the earth in the latter days, and though my worm shall eat my flesh, yet in my flesh I'll see God. His great confession of the fact that he would be resurrected and see this Redeemer who has redeemed him. Isn't that a wonderful text? And again, Gael is the term being used there. Psalm 26, there's a jillion psalms where the psalmist will speak of God redeeming him from all his evil, from all his distress. So you got this idea constantly of God's rescuing of an individual from trouble. And I can bore you to tears with events in my life where God has done exactly that. And you can bore me to tears with events in your life where you couldn't see a way out, you had no hope, you're in danger, whatever the case was, and God stepped into the picture. We call it having a God moment. God comes to our rescue. And that's what David is confessing. That's what Jacob's confessing. That's what the psalmists are confessing. And then the way we think of redemption in the New Testament is not a physical deliverance of some sort. It's a spiritual deliverance. And to my knowledge, there is only one text in all the Old Testament that speaks of God's redemption in that sense. The sense that we will see when we look at the New Testament is the dominant sense. This one text is the only place, to my knowledge. If you find it elsewhere, let me know. Psalm 130. Psalm 130. And Psalm 130 is an interesting psalm. In fact, let me read you part of that psalm. Out of the depths I have cried unto thee, O Lord. Lord, hear my voice. Let thine ears be attentive to the voice of my supplications. If thou, Lord, shouldest mark iniquities, who shall stand? Now, it's like he's asking for rescue, all right, but here we get a glimpse into rescued from what? And notice that it is the justice of God Almighty. If you mark iniquities, if you count my sins against me, I'm a doomed and damned man. That's what he's saying. But there is forgiveness with thee, that thou mayest be feared. I wait for the Lord, my soul doth wait, in his word do I hope. My soul waiteth for the Lord more than they that watch for the morning. I say, more than they that watch for the morning. Let Israel hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is mercy, and with him is plenteous redemption. And it's the word padah, that substitutionary redemption. You begin to see how this is going to tie into the book of Romans, where we're going to go next week. He shall redeem Israel, not from Babylon, not from Assyria, from all his iniquities. As far as I know, this is the only place in the Old Testament where you see redemption as we would think of it in the New Testament concept. So it's not absent, but it's just not prominent, because what you've got over and over again in the Old Testament is a picture of redemption. God coming to the rescue of a firstborn son on Passover night in Egypt, of Israel itself at the Red Sea, of Israel from bondage in Babylon later on. These individuals like David and Jacob who say, God has rescued me over and over again. David at one time confessed, I'm just one step from death. And then this in Psalm 130. The real thing we need redeeming from is our iniquities, our sin. All right, we're going to leave this and we'll come back next week and we'll take a look at how redemption works over in the New Testament. So there'll be a test on this, you know, come ready. Test your Hebrew. But hopefully that gives you a sense of the background of these terms, like this is the glossary. This is how you ought to understand this word. Let's spend some time in prayer tonight.